This is the Land and Legacy Podcast, brought to you by Whitetail Properties Real Estate. We're your hosts, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye. This is your weekly resource for habitat management, wildlife management, and recreational real estate. We hope you guys enjoy the show.
All right, guys, welcome back. Land and Legacy Podcast. It's Adam here. We are in the heart of it. You know, I think I said that last week, so I'll try to give you a different intro, but we are in the middle of November now, coming up on the middle of November, and peak breeding, peak rut, all the things that make it exciting for us as hunters. And this is the time of the year that we start getting the texts and we get the phone calls and the emails from clients who have had success. And it's kind of a chance for us to reconnect and hear, you know, what they're seeing on their farms and what tweaks or if any tweaks need to be made, what they're observing as far as, you're seeing more quail or you've had more deer on daylight, all the things that, you know, why we get hired. And we're going to jump in with a landowner out of Missouri, but Illinois resident. So if you are a listener that has a farm more than just a quick afternoon drive, so a couple of hours away or over an hour away, and you're navigating, trying to do the improvements, being a dad, being a husband, and also trying to be a successful deer hunter, this is your podcast. So we've got our longtime friend and Land and Legacy client Jay Dirks on the line. Jay, good to have you here.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Yeah. So Jay, you and I, you were one of the guys way back when we first launched Land and Legacy. I remember didn't take very long, and I saw your name popping up in the comments. So you've been a follower, commenter of what we've been doing, and then we worked your property. And we were talking before the show. We believe it was 2019 when I was there. I thought it was pre-COVID. And you were thinking it was right there in COVID. I'm thinking it was 2019. Could be wrong. It could have been. Well, no, it had to be 2019 because early 2020 was when when COVID broke and like the shutdowns and lockdowns and all that stuff started to happen. I was at QDMA National Convention, Whitetail Weekend at headquarters. And that was before they changed the name, when they still had headquarters, all that stuff. So it had to be 2019 that I was there.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like I said, these last 3 years, it's just been
a blur.
Pretty much a blur, you know. Yep. So you know how it is with having a young family and trying to get everything done. It just, I don't remember what I did 3 weeks ago. So
yep, I'm right there with you. For us. But, When we started Land and Legacy 2017, it was like, and I have weird ways of remembering kind of the time frame, but we started in 2017, and it was like all of a sudden, boom! Now it's 2020, and I look back and I'm like, whoa! There's a lot of states and a lot of landowners in between, and I have no idea if it was this year or that year. Or was it 2020 or 2019? It's all a blur. And then you throw kids on top of that, and it's just like out the door. I don't have a memory for it.
Yeah, it's just like stomping on the accelerator pedal.
That's
when you
right.
think you know what you're doing. When I first heard you guys with the Land and Legacy, I was kind of, it was a breath of fresh air hearing something different. I kind of like to go. I like people that aren't selling you stuff and, you know, teaching. And
yep.
Ever since then, I kind of was like, you know, this guy, it's not just a gimmick. And then I practiced a small amount of it at my home here, which was originally 8 acres in Illinois, which it's now 26 acres. But I don't know if I was starting to look more or if I was just noticing more, but we went from having zero deer tracks in the winter in the snow to, you know, 15, 20 deer in the heart of it. And from then on, I'm like, there's something to this.
Yeah.
So it took me a while to get you out, but I started to realize after a couple failed attempts of just I couldn't mentally rearrange everything in a neat order, and I kept doubting that I was doing it right. So I thought, let's get some more eyes on this. So.
Yep. That's awesome. You know, when we were first, when I first visited, I remember we stepped out of the truck and there was quail whistling. I was like, oh, yeah, that's nice. This is cool. And I believe the original, like, layout was you owned a piece, your dad owned a piece. It was all one contiguous area, and it was pretty much wide open timber with plans to start doing a bunch of restoration. But you hadn't really gotten to that point yet, and like a lot of our listeners, you were trying to balance the we're several hours away, about 4 hours away, from home to the farm, and so we really have to plan out when we're coming. And then I also have, at that point, I think you had two really young girls.
That's correct.
And so it was like, yeah, the chance of you just being there every weekend to hammer away on habitat is not happening. And so, you know, I think one of our big plans was, okay, let's start trying to restore this. And, you know, like a lot of guys, similar, you know, some of the big plans were big goals where we wanted to improve habitat, or that's what you and your father had said. You wanted to improve habitat. You wanted to improve the deer hunting through improving the habitat. And overall, I think you said you wanted, you know, I'm going to guess that you wanted to do a lot of work for other species that weren't just game species. And it was like, okay, that's the plan. We need to restore the timber, manage the timber, implement prescribed fire, and really do some stuff that is going to be more beneficial but not require us to be here every weekend. And that was really kind of the path that we decided to go down. And, you know, it's been a wild couple of years, but this year you made it all come together.
Yeah, so we about the same time we had contacted you, we knew there was going to be a timber harvest in the near future. We had done one 5 years prior, and we realized that, well, if we're going to do this harvest, if there might be some added features that we want to put in, we'd rather have the timber consultant and the logger go ahead and do that with their equipment while they were there. And at that same time, we also had a state forester meeting with us, and he was able to give us some heads up on some of these EQIP programs that were allowed, and we could really kind of snowball the money that we put into versus the money we get out of it. So after talking to you, we were able to develop a plan. We took that to the consulting forester. He actually was on the same page. We were able to find one that had the same realization and knew, you know, it's not so much about the going in there and just taking the best trees, but we're creating a thinning, and you know, not every tree here is supposed to be here. And once we got that understood, we started applying for EQIP programs, which takes about a year. So we put in, we got passed up the first year. And that whole time, the timber had been sold and logged. We finally got got accepted for the EQIP paperwork like 4 days after my father passed away. So then it was kind of like, all right, well, we need to get this done. And living 4 hours away from home, trying to manage getting down there, I could only devote really 3 days, like a long weekend, a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So that first year during the logging, my dad wasn't there to witness any of it. So I spent that first summer just going down and making sure that the loggers were taking the trees they were supposed to, communicating with the forestry consultant that the plan was still being stuck with. And it wasn't that impressive. The logging company we had wasn't as diligent as the one we had 5 years prior, but it's still, you have to almost prepare yourself for what you're going to see, because it's hard to take in at first. But then even this year, this would be one full year since logging. It looks a lot better, and then having the post-harvest TSI.
Yeah.
So
talk to me a little bit about, you know, when we got there, you know, the logging was going to be completed. There were some varying logging intensities that were going to be done on the farm. And if I remember right, there was a savanna restoration area, and then there was some woodland restoration area. What was that like? Did you enter that into an EQIP contract?
We did, and that was reflected. That was reflected on the logger, the way the timber was marked and taken out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite a change. But mainly going into the post-harvest TSI, that's where we've seen a lot of the results, getting rid of a lot of the dogwood and a lot of the hickory that was starting to take over some of the oak regeneration.
Yep. And then follow it fire, since it's savanna and woodland restoration.
That's correct. So we've been able to, you know, burning in the state of Missouri, it's got some great cost share incentives. This last year, I think it burned 40 acres total. I think it came out to a little over $2,000. And that was just taking pretty much one full day of burning with three guys. So
yeah, that's awesome. Burning with your buddies.
Burning with your buddy and collecting a check. And just recently, I met with a Quail Forever biologist to set up a plan on the tillable ground. And walking in on that side, he said, this is probably one of the best oak timbers I've seen in this county, just because of that work. People are afraid of doing the TSI, but it mainly comes down to getting the work scheduled. So,
yeah.
We when we got the EQIP program and got approved for it, I don't remember what the total cost per acre, because it varies on what the plan calls for. I think we got paid $16,000 to cut a little over 140 acres.
Yep.
And the total cost to us was like $18,000.
Hmm.
So that took a little over a month, but that put us years ahead of trying to piecemeal it together.
Mm-hmm.
10-acre blocks at a time.
Yeah.
And then in the logging contract, we had applied for some forest openings and got approved shortly before the logging had started. So we had the logger cut in these openings. I can't remember exactly what the cost share was on that. I think it was $800 an opening. And then all of the existing trails, logging trails, like a main defined trail, we got 4 acres total that were planted, seeded, limed, and water bar, and that was an extra $8,000, I believe, on top of that. So I was able to, in a weekend with the skid loader, I was able to finish up putting in the water bars and leveling out, grinding the stumps out of the clear cuts.
Nice. That's awesome. So you've done all kinds of different cost share, EQIP cost share. Just for our listeners who may be going, whoa, that sounded like a lot. What are some of those? Did you do woodland restoration?
I wasn't able to get the woodland restoration. I looked into it now. So once you've done a lot of these practices, you're able to get into a conservation stewardship program. I believe that's what it's called.
Yep, CSP.
Through an NRCS. And once you get into that, they categorize your property, all of your property that is not usable ground or not leased or farmed. It gets evaluated in one chunk, so everything in your name, even in different states. But they give you this rating, and then it's kind of like they pay you, I believe, up to a certain amount for a 5-year contract. They're paying you to keep doing the practices. So they pay you like $1,000 a year for 5 years, but then you're able to do like some more of these more micro conservation plans. Like you can do snag tree habitat for bats. I think it pays like $1,000 an acre, mm-hmm. which is just girdling some trees. Yeah. And then if you wanted to get into brush management, if you haven't already done that.
Nice.
But I find that that's a great way, you know, for living 4 hours away, that's a great way to make some income and get some stuff covered. If you can get down there and set up a couple meetings, and if you got time at home to schedule meetings and get stuff planned out ahead of time, it allows you to make that money to pay to have the larger projects done. So we'd never had the TSI done if we weren't able to have the capability of putting the logging roads in ourselves. And that, in the end, all the cost share was an offset because I was able to do a large majority of the work that required a skid loader for nothing or little to nothing.
Yeah. Man. And so for what's the total acreage of timber ground?
It's let's see, 143.
And then you have how many acres that are like open food plots, not the crop?
Oh,
it's very little. Well, I remember it's being very little.
According to the government contract, 4 acres.
Okay. Yeah.
And these are not planted food plots per se. These we were able to get them enrolled as logging decks.
Yep.
And so when you get signed off on that, it has to be restored. They were requiring you to plant it in orchard grass. Or, you know, their whole goal is to not let the soil. But I kind of argued my side is I don't want to plant it in something that's not usable. So I was able to get them to write in, you know, getting a pollinator mix put in, which it costs a little bit more, but it ended up working out. Hindsight, I think it's going to be a better payoff. I've already seen deer utilizing that spot
way more than more it would than, if it was orchard grass.
Yeah, that whole thing, that's kind of, I did the whole government thing. I work for the government, and I've worked in the military, so I get, you know, the guy that's just following the rules, he might not agree with it, but that's his job. So, yeah. You know, a lot of that, you know, according to the EQIP program, to these trails, it required, without a soil test, you had to put a minimum amount of lime, which I believe was, it was like 1,000 active units, or however that works, per acre.
Yeah.
And the one gentleman at the NRCS office, he's like, well, you just have to get like a interrogator or something to put that lime on. And I'm like, sir, I don't know. You can only spread like at a minimum 30 foot, and these trails are only 20 foot wide. So I ended up, instead of going and buying bag pelletized lime, I got egg lime dumped from a semi, then I use the dump trailer to transport it to these openings, and then I spread it out with the skid loader down the trails. Mm-hmm. But it was always fascinating to me that they require you to add all these inputs. I had to add 300 pounds of PK and N, and I was still planting natives, but I guess I digress on that. We showed the receipts and we did it, so.
Nice. What has been some of your favorite projects that you've done where you were like, that was, you know, like out of all the things, what has been your favorite?
Well, I would say the TSI, and I didn't do it. I just got to see the aftermath, and I'm not as skilled in forestry. I guess I know a little bit about a lot of things. So I get the concept of it. It's nice to see to see it in action, see someone else's, it's almost like painting.
Yep.
So when you're out there and you see kind of what was chose to live and die and see how thick it gets and know that it was the timber was somewhat thick to start with, but now having basically the whole 140 acres of my dad's timber, TSI'd post-harvest, there's not a single piece of that property that you can stand on the ground and see more than 30 yards. It's almost to the point where it's impassable without these logging trails.
Wow.
Now you can set up on those points and you can see down into these ravines on each side, but if you get down there and just to walk around, it's to the point where that alone makes you decide whether or not you want to shoot a deer or not, because it's almost to the point now where if you were to shoot a deer and it runs 70, 80 yards off the trail, it's so thick in some of these bottoms that you'd almost have to bring a chainsaw in and cut a path to drag the deer out, or you'd have to lay it on the ground and cape it, cut it out there and just pack it out.
Wow.
Which I find it kind of cool, because it makes guys think, like, you know, it's almost like hunting public land on private ground, because I did it once, post-harvest DSI, I had shot a doe last year, and it was me and a cousin dragging that deer out, and it took 3 hours to move this deer 150 yards.
Oh, man.
And after doing that, it was like, all right, well, we're going to have to choose our spots a little bit better. So,
yep.
I would say that's the coolest, as far as like visual, but doing the fire, that's a game changer. That's something that I've dabbled in a little bit before consulting with you, but I also dabbled in it without doing TSI. And this year, we had the post-harvest TSI done last fall, and we burnt early spring. We did a 20-acre piece on my dad's and a 20-acre piece on mine. And I've gotten calls and text messages from the neighbor that's got a 40 to the north about, man, we're seeing a lot of turkey this year. And earlier conversation with him, he's like, man, I'm seeing a lot of young bucks this year.
Yeah.
And so that's really reassuring. I mean, that's we've always had a problem with a lot of does, but now there's just everything there. My buddy told me last week, and when we were hunting down there, that he jumped up a quail, and that's pretty cool. I take it for granted that 15 years ago when I first came down there and was hunting along like the edge of the field, you'd see like 15 quail come through there, and I thought it was just a nuisance bird. I never knew much about it.
Yeah.
And then you think the last 10 years, I've never seen a quail.
Yeah.
In that timber. And then for him to say, yeah, I bumped one walking in on some area that had been, I don't know what the heck's it called. Or you.
Edge feathered?
Edge feather. Yes, that's correct. So I was like, damn. I can only see it in the future getting better.
No doubt.
I guess I expected it to happen, but now that it's actually happening.
Are you seeing any quail? Because this is what we've noticed on the places that we've cut and burned. We've seen quail in areas we've never seen quail. Like in what was once closed canopy forest, now there's like the occasional quail. And you're like, what in the world? Like, I never would have guessed deer or quail would be in those areas. Have you guys, or is it just too thick? I'm sure you're not out walking around through that stuff.
Well, that's these last 2 years have just been, every time I've went down to the farm, I've been working on a project. So I've not, that's the one downside.
Yep.
To this, but I'll be able, you know, I'll get to experience more of that. Not everyone has to pound it through as fast as I did mine. I basically did mine because it was a tribute to my dad, and I just had a goal where we took a five a 5-year equip commitment, and I was able to finish it in 12 months.
Nice.
So that was just my goal. I just lost all sight on anything else, and it was just get this done. As a matter of fact, last year I went a whole year without walking outside of my like main trail to my property. I hadn't even taken one step in, and that kind of caught up to me, you know, at the end of hunting season last year, where it was kind of emotional to the point where you just try and get all this done, and then you feel guilty about enjoying your property because you got to try and make everything happen in 3 days.
Yes. Yep. And I think Chad and I, we deal with that where it's like, you know, since buying the farm, it's been, okay, well, we need to get our forestry management plan done. We need to get our fences built. We got to move the cows. We got to do this. We got to do that. Now I'm working on the water lines, so there's water tanks and everything for the cows. And it's just like, so when a day comes that we're, for whatever reason, the hunting, you know, we're at the farm and we were planning on hunting, and we get to looking at the wind and like, the wind's just terrible. Hey, we're up here doing this, and it's like, now's the chance. Even though it's deer season, it's like, hey, let's go look at this. And it's like, man, that's really the stuff that excites us and motivates us to continue doing it. But it's really easy, and especially for you, Jay, in utilizing these equip contracts, these different cost share opportunities, is like those have deadlines. And it's dealing with the government, and you're like, oh, I do not want to have the government breathing down my neck. And so you're just like, I got to peck away. But at the same time, the bad side of that is you may get so busy doing it, especially if time is limited, that you don't get to enjoy your farm during that period of time.
Yeah, and I guess I might be seeming a little negative about it, but I also keep in mind, like, it was also going down there was also like my way of connecting. So, you know, it seems like a lot of work, but really that's the only place I wanted to be at that time.
Yeah.
So it was my medicine to help me focus. I think a lot of people have the same connection, like running a chainsaw. It's the closest resemblance to me as being like in combat, as far as like being hyper focused. Everything is kind of like this zen where you have one task and you're focused on it, and everything else is just shut out. And so that's a lot of the time, that's what keeps me sane. So I don't know, I guess, where I'm going with that, but I think people can relate that it's a lot of work, but the benefits, even in 1 year, has been outstanding.
I agree with you 100%. Whenever you're doing that chainsaw work, even though it's a lot of work, and you run out of gas, which is like, okay, now you're forced to take a break. I got to walk back up and fill this thing up. It's in that you like look down, you're like, I am drenched in sweat right now, but I am so on fire. Like, I feel great. This is cool. I'm making stuff happen. And I think that's where, you know, if you're hiring contract crews to do it, yeah, you miss out on that, but you're still getting work done. But if you're not doing any of that and you're just letting your timber set, and even though it needs the work, you're missing out on a really cool aspect of being a landowner.
Yeah, because I think one thing that hunters take for granted, and I did all the way up until like 2015, before I bought my house in Illinois and was there all the time, is, you know, before it was all about deer, and you're just laser focused on deer, but you step over all these other amazing things, and you guys had started talking about plants. So then I go on that kick, and I get the plant ID, and what humbled me is, you know, you start to realize how little you know about stuff that you thought you knew everything about.
Yep.
And that's probably the biggest highlight of just getting a plan, getting someone in there to motivate you, is you know, my kids are going to see things that other kids will not get to ever witness.
Yeah.
You know, like you said it, you know, finding like the yellow lady slippers.
Yep.
Like I can almost guarantee in my daughter's school, 120 kids, there's only my daughter's ever going to see that plant.
Yeah.
Unless they go to like an arboretum. And that in the last couple of years, my goals have kind of shifted away more. Like hunting is the cherry on top, but I can take my 6-year-old daughter and 4-year-old daughter out there, and they get to see things that people take for granted or just don't know, or just don't, you know, they get to walk through a timber here in a park or a state park. Well, a state park in Illinois is probably the worst example of what a timber can be. You know, it's 8-foot tall bush honeysuckle with nothing growing underneath, and that's sad that that's where kids, that's their only exposure. So that's the other thing that fuels me on this conservation. Deer hunting is just the cherry on top of it.
Yep.
If anything, I would say I'm a very marginal hunter at the most.
Yeah. You've said something about the lady slippers that cracked me up, because I was thinking about I don't think I've shared it on the podcast. If I have and people have heard it before, my apologies. We were, so a couple of weeks ago, I guess it was probably over a month ago now. In fact, I know it was early October. We had to take my youngest daughter to St. Louis for some checkups for just different things. And she's great, in case anybody's curious. But it's totally fine. But we do have to go and take her to get checked in on once a year. And while we were up there, we went to eat at one of the famous barbecue places. And we're sitting there, and there was flowers outside. And my oldest daughter, Maya, she goes, "Look, Daddy, it's a yellow sulfur." Which I personally have not been into butterflies very long in my life, so I don't know a great deal about all the different types of butterflies. I know the ones you see very commonly, but I don't know some of the others. And so she has a book. I think it's like the Berenstain Bears book, one of them. And it shows like 3 different butterflies, and it's a monarch, a black swallowtail, and a yellow sulfur. And so at that point, I'm like, I don't even know what a yellow sulfur looks like or if I've ever even seen one. This butterfly flies in, and she goes, "Look, Daddy, it's a yellow sulfur." And I look over, and I'm like, "Huh, it is a yellow butterfly." And so I real quick Googled yellow sulfur. By golly, she was right. It was a yellow sulfur. And and I'm just like, I crack up. I'm like, this kid is going to have a world of natural resources that she's going to get to grow up learning about. And it's unfortunate that a lot of kids don't get that.
Yeah, that's my proudest dad moment, is when you got your daughter or daughters or kids walking around, they're naming off these plants. And grown-ups are like, "How do you know that?" But, you know, it's kind of like, you know, at that age, they're so curious about everything. And it kind of makes you think, like, why did I not? I was above that. I guess you don't know what you're losing if you don't know you have it.
Yep.
And so that, you know, I didn't know that I was losing quail, just mainly because I didn't know. Had I known, I would have done something different about it years ago. And now that I know, we're making plans to change that. We're taking out 24 acres of tillable ground, and we're going to put it into, I believe it's continuous CRP. Next year. So, and that program alone, I think 10% of that you can put into food plots. Only half of it's plantable per year, then you have to leave it fallow. But being able to have you know, well, it would be it'd be 2.4 acres, but an acre of any sort of food plot, that's one thing that we lack. But having a field that's already tilled and leveled, even if we can leave out an extra acre of just, it's not in any program, it'll be the first time in Missouri we'll have standing grain in late season.
Yeah.
I won't even have to go down and hunt the rut. I'll be able to go down a cold front. I can spend more time with my family, avoid the whole 10-day rifle season, which is just stressful beyond all get out. and get my deer or see a lot of deer. So that's the end game. That's the end goal.
Yeah. Yep. I think that's one of the big things. So before we, you know, as we're getting through this podcast, it'd be unfair to talk about the recent success had. And that's really kind of the focus and why I said you got to come on a podcast, man, because you live 4 hours away. You have two young girls and you're trying to manage a farm and find time to hunt while also not completely abandoning your family during hunting season. So talk to me. Let's break it down as in what was your hunting season like leading up to this hunt?
So I would say I hunted a weekend in September, opening weekend, and I hunted a weekend the first weekend or two in October. But I mainly went down. I had a project to do. One time I was meeting with a Quail Forever biologist, so I just decided to hunt. The second time was something to do with the house, getting something done in the house. So I went. I was not super aggressive. I kind of hunt. I hunted some of those newly established openings. Mainly it was to kill two birds with one stone, check and see how the seeding was doing, and then hunting. And yeah. Then the second time I went down, I did the same thing. But then I devoted a four-day trip down last weekend, and it was kind of a last-minute thing. A buddy that's been with me through this journey finally was able to get some time off from work, so we went down to hunt. And the weather's not been very good these last couple of years. South wind seems to be predominant now in early part of November. So we were hunting it fairly delicate the first 2 days with high winds in the 20-mile-an-hour range with 60-degree temps. And it was brutal. But on the Saturday night, I sat down and looked at the map, an aerial map that was updated shortly after the post-harvest TSI was done. And some of the areas that we had the logging take out a lot more timber, like the savanna areas and where we were going to put in some bedding thickets, it showed up on that aerial. And the light bulb went off in my head, like, this is exactly what Adam's been talking about. So I told my buddy, I said, I think I'm going to go in and I'm going to walk down this trail until I see sign, but I'm going to be on the downwind side of this pretty open spot and just play my cards. Just kind of go for broke.
Yep.
And so went in there and sat for, almost 3 hours without seeing anything and had a doe come skirting the outside of that thick bedding area, and I was able to get an arrow in her at 20 yards away broadside.
Nice.
And at that moment, that's really kind of what my hunting was going to be. That's kind of how I felt it was going to be for the year. And behind me downwind, I don't know why. I don't know. I can't base it off of my hunting knowledge, but for some reason this buck decided that he was going to be downwind. I don't know if he was bedded on this east-facing ridge, and it was just cooler there, and he wasn't disturbed. But he had gotten up at about 5:45, and since it was so windy, it's so windy and so thick in that part of the timber, unless you're physically looking at the spot where a deer has moved, you just cannot see them. Yeah. They either have to be on the logging trail or directly in front of your vision, or you just can't see them. So a lot of it wasn't great hunting because a lot of it has to be done audio. But I heard over my shoulder a sapling moving. And I look and I'm like, it's kind of weird to have a squirrel in a tree that small. And it's really making some noise. And I look at it a little more and I'm like, man, that must be a buck. And sure enough, some tines popped up. And it didn't look very impressive. It was about 80 yards away. I could just see the tips of the tines. So I turned back around. He worked that rub for 2 or 3 minutes and decided to turn and head straight up the hill towards the bedding thicket in front of me. And he was going to cross east and west, kind of on the downwind side of this thicket. And he was able to come within 10 yards. And and put an arrow in him, and that was just a flush of emotion. So
nice.
I actually got to watch him go down. He ended up dying 30 yards away from the logging trail. It was an easy drag. And it was at that time, I didn't even take any harvest photos. It wasn't about anyone else. It was just like, I don't know. I don't know how to explain it without getting really emotional. So
yeah, I know you had texted me, or you had sent me a message and said that you had killed one, and I knew the train of emotions had to be rolling with everything that you've endured and since the beginning of the farm journey, since I was first there. So much has happened. So much has changed. So much has been improved. And like you mentioned earlier, you lost your father, who was a big part of that whole movement in you. You know, the day I visited, he was there with us. And so in seeing that transition from lower quality habitat to now much more improved habitat, you're starting to get to see the benefits. And so I knew the emotions had to be almost overwhelming. I know they would be for me.
Well, it kind of reminds me, I think, the last time you'd spoken my name on a podcast was because I said something along the lines of, killing a buck in a big timber in the rut is purely luck. And you had taken that to heart.
Yeah.
And laid out, you know, how you can change that. And by golly, if it wasn't 4 years later, I pretty much followed your steps and made it happen and realized that, okay, there's a little bit of luck, but a lot of being in the right spot and knowing where the right spot's at, being able to control that spot, because this timber is a part of almost 500 acres of continuous oak hickory timber.
Yeah.
And so being able to find a buck that scores almost 140 inches and getting an arrow in them, it's a miracle in its own. So
yeah, it's a lot
the
like
the fact that you guys are doing it down there on your big piece. I don't know. I'm sure there's some people that realize how hard it is to do. Maybe I'm overselling it. Maybe it's easy to some, but my golly, it's been a challenge with the bow.
It is. You go into big timber, there is a reason why so many people, so many hunting shows, like when you think about people that are trying to make a, you know, whatever, a name for themselves, get publicity, get fame, I don't know, get people's eyes and build a following. A lot of them do not go to big timber to make it happen. And
no.
And so, like, for people that have hunted big timber and hunted especially heavy terrain big timber, which usually go hand in hand, but there are some areas of big flat timber. Once you get into these deep cut ravines and these steep ridges and throw in timber on top of that, it gets very challenging. And so it's always fun to talk to a landowner who, like yourself, has limited time and has the ability to climb into a tree and put an arrow in a big deer and get to experience what it's like on the downwind side of a bedding cut in early November or late October and get to see that, man, this stuff works. And then it's like once it clicks, then there's more deer to come because you start to learn how to do it. It's like a trapper who's learning how to trap coyotes. You have to figure out how to get him to put his foot, his paw right perfectly on that pad or on that pan of that trap. And if you're off, if your scent is wrong, they're going to roll in it. They're going to step on it weird. They're not going to get trapped. And so for a deer hunter, what we're trying to do is create an area that is basically a trap site where a deer is going to put its body and you're going to be in a 20-yard, 30-yard circle in range of that deer. That's what we're trying to create. So when it comes together, it's just like saying that I took this entire 500 acres and I put this little trap down and a coyote stepped perfectly on it and I was able to have a cool pelt. And I think that's what, you know, that's my best analogy for guys to say, to understand what it's like to lay out a plan in big timber and make it happen.
And I will say one thing, it's way more enjoyable to put all of your energy into the timber, and you get all these other benefits. The TSI, you get to see your oaks. Maybe you'll get two harvests in your lifetime opposed to maybe one. It's getting to see rare and endangered plants where, you know, there had been 10 years of failed food plots before that.
Yeah.
To where there's nothing more life-stealing than putting a full weekend of prep work into tilling and disking a food plot to come in there to hunt it and have it be just dirt or having a failure. And
No doubt.
It's probably one of the first podcasts you'd put on. You had talked about that. And from that day forward, I've got, I guess, air quotes, clover plots that have been, I don't know, they're probably 8 years old. And I see way more hunting advantage out of just hunting a thicket in the rut than, you know, spending countless evenings. Because the deer that I shot last Saturday evening, he was never going to make it in the daylight to any of the openings that we had.
Yeah.
Never would have made it.
Never would have made it. Yep.
And that goes for any buck I've shot down there has never been close to a food plot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really not that shocking to hear it. But, man, it is shocking for a lot of people to hear it because so much emphasis is put on food plots. Not to say they're bad, but if you like, for you, you have a limited budget, or not a limited budget, a limited time to go and put in food plots, but you don't want to have a huge budget for the food plots that are also going to be fail, like you said they had. So you're trying to figure out how to get the best bang for your buck and your best return on your investment, and the investment being time and money. And you did the food plot game. Now you've done the habitat game, and you're seeing a far superior return from focusing on the habitat than the food plots.
Yeah, we're getting, you know, pictures of 20 turkeys at a time coming through there. And I'm not a turkey hunter, so. But to me, I mean, that, you know, if we can hold on to that small little area and keep the recruitment, maybe we'll have turkeys when the surrounding townships around don't. That's my plans. I definitely don't fret too much about coyotes, because there's enough deer there that they can eat as many deer as they want.
Yep. Oh man, that's exciting times in Missouri for you on the farm, and I can't wait to hear more and continue to see pictures. And for a lot of our listeners, guys, this is just one more example of the benefit and having a having a plan in place and executing on that plan. And really for Jay and this just under 200 acre farm that's mostly timber, having the ability to TSI it and burn it, put in bedding cuts, and do all that really with less than a handful of people is really quite remarkable. So it should encourage every single one of you that, you know, it may seem like a lot, but you can always do more than just food plots. And so
I'll say that the equip money alone, like the small projects that guys can do, like brush management, and you know, if they can get enrolled in like a log deck or a forest opening and do the trails and put the water bars in, that extra money that you make on those smaller projects will more than offset the cost of the TSI. And that TSI, that should have been done 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I think if you looked at an actual spreadsheet, I think we're probably $3,000 ahead on it, and that's not even that's including pure profit off of the logging on its own.
That's awesome. Very cool. Well, man, I appreciate you coming on and sharing your story.
All right. Well, you guys have a good day.
Yeah.